This month's podcast features highlights from our podcasts from this past year, with a focus on educational topics. Today, you'll hear excerpts from our conversations with students at Needham High School, Dr. John Brown, Michael Horn, Issa Zimmerman, and Ed Lambert. This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of online learning resources, training, and support. JFY's individualized self-paced curriculum helps raise individual and school performance by maintaining grade-level skills and targeted unfinished learning. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. The school year began in September with all students in Massachusetts returning to in-person learning. And our podcast that month featured a conversation with Bailey, Jason, and Jack, students from Needham High School, and the difference between attending school online and returning to the classroom.
I think just because of the grade that we were in last year, it was stressful. But I think had we been freshmen, or I think specifically sophomores last year, it wouldn't have been that stressful. But I think just because of the classes that we were taking, it tended to be stressful. But I think like not being in school full time also helped with the stress, because I know I was able to get a lot more work done during the day. Because let's say I was taking an online class and I didn't particularly need to pay that close attention, I could do my other classwork during that class and not have to like hide it or something.
So I also liked online classes a lot, although I didn't learn nearly as much as I should have. I really enjoyed them because when you had them, you got to sleep in, you got to not pay close attention, you know, you got to do other work on the side, you got to play games if you're me. But overall, I think in school is just better as a whole. And even though it's a little bit more annoying that you can't do as many things, I think for my education, it'll just be more beneficial.
So going off the stress question again, I would say that last year, I mean, we're only 2 weeks into the school year, but I would say last year, the teachers really held back. I was definitely stressed the whole year, but consistently in many of my classes, teachers would say, oh, because we're virtual, or oh, because of COVID, we're not doing so and so like we normally would, which I don't know. I feel like makes sense because many of the teachers didn't teach online very effectively and weren't able to cover as much as they would be able to in person. But it definitely led to a less stressful environment with more personal work. Instead of do this work during class, then you do this homework, it mainly felt like, okay, here's time, do work and homework, do whatever you can to get done. And it generally led to less work and less difficult work even.
Even though like maybe we didn't learn as much as we possibly could have during that year, honestly, most of the stuff that we learned last year, we aren't really going to use this year. And like, for example, something that's not like that is like pre-calc. We didn't get to do all of the units, but as a result of that, we just had to do some summer work. But let's say I didn't get to all the units in chemistry last year. That is not going to affect me in any way because I'm not going to use that in my life.
Yeah. I mean, for the most part, we learned all the fundamentals that we need to know, and we didn't really learn much else. So every single class got all the important things out of the way as fast as possible. And so we only had a little bit of time for other fancier, more extravagant things. But I mean, for the most part, everything that we needed to know, they got out there and they did an effective job at teaching it.
So a lot of the stuff, we covered everything that was really important. I didn't feel like any classes really cut something out of the curriculum that was helpful for the future and helpful for learning or helpful for essay writing, especially in classes like the AP classes, which have a set curriculum that they need to teach for a test at the end of the year. They were still able to teach that stuff, but it felt like there was less work that physically accompanied it rather than just the typical year where there's an immense amount of work, but also you just learn the same concepts. A lot of what needed to be taught was taught.
The students, beginning their senior year, also talked about the upcoming college application process.
I mean, I'm hoping that it goes more back to normal because I know last year it was extremely competitive, especially because 2 years prior, so people going to 2020, a lot of people delayed their admissions and then it got pushed to last year. So hopefully that won't affect our year as much. But I think there's also, people say that it's more difficult because of test optional, because schools won't be able to see that. But even when schools say they're test optional, they're not really test optional. Like, that's in cases where they know, like, you're in some situation where you will not be able to take whatever test you want to take. So if we don't submit test scores, I think that there's some disadvantage there.
Our August podcast featured Dr. John Brown, clinical associate professor at the UMass Lowell School of Education, and he was very candid about his less than stellar beginnings as a high school teacher. After teaching at a school for special education students, he moved to Shawshene Valley Technical High School and was not nearly prepared for the change.
One of the main things I was doing that I didn't realize at first was I was forcing students less. I was being less forceful as I continued to teach at that school. And I learned that because I was so bad the first year that when I decided I would come back, I needed to know what these students were like. So I started asking their shop teachers, can I watch you guys, you know, work? And these guys didn't have college degrees. I'm still friends with some of them. They had dirt under their fingernails. They're great teachers, but I was a snob about it because I didn't know. And I was, can I watch you guys teach? I was thinking, what can they teach me? But the students loved going to shop. And then they clearly became successful electricians and plumbers and bakers and, you know, and nurses. And I'm like, how does that happen? These students who won't even open their book for me are going to be successful nurses? Like, how is that? So I start... The teachers, the voc ed teachers were like, all right, they were suspicious of me. They were like, all right, we'll let you sit in the corner over there. Just don't make any noise. And I think they thought that I was maybe a spy or something. And they quickly realized I wasn't, that I was just an idiot. And I was just fumbling along. And I'd ask them questions later. And that's what really gave me away as being a fool. Like, how do you get the students to, you know, to try at this skill, whatever it was, like they were building a house 1 year for Habitat for Humanity. And how do you get them to try, you know, using a nail gun? There was a student who was like a sophomore, and she was a girl, and she's unstable with the nail gun. She's like, are you sure I can do it? Yeah. And she fires the thing off and it goes wrong. it doesn't hit it right. It splits the stud and the teacher says, well, what you guys do in academia is you give them an F when that happens. But we say, do it over. And I said, I don't get it. And he's like, yeah, I can see that. But what you don't get is that failure is part of our curriculum here. So if somebody brings their car into the auto shop, and which ended up happening to me later on, and they need to replace your starter, and the kid accidentally puts a hole in your radiator, we don't yell at them for that because we want to reward or affirm, or we don't want them to be to not try. We want them to take risks. And I knew this from my world as an academic risk, taking an academic risk. And he was right. We had been punishing students. I had been doing it too, part of a big club of people who would punish students for not being compliant, you know, not sitting down and paying attention and asking too many questions. And so I started doing that. I started saying, so what do you guys have any questions? And they would ask a million questions. And I would say, okay, that's enough. And I went back to the shop teachers, like, they have to ask all their questions. That is an important part of their learning, is asking all those questions. I'm like, why? Because they need to know that stuff, the teachers would say, and they need to feel heard. I'm like, yeah, but I'm not going to get all the curriculum in. If I let them ask all that questions, we'll get nothing else done. He goes, it doesn't matter. You know, the teachers would say, the tech teachers would say, it doesn't matter whether you get that stuff done or not. Because if you get it done, it doesn't mean they learned it. It just means that you were talking. And I'm like, and they're, the voc tech teachers, these vocational technical teachers were so plain spoken and so direct with me that I couldn't not see it. And then I'd go and I'd do it, like I'd skip my lunch and watch like the masonry teacher teach students how to build a wall. And then I'd quickly run back to, because I didn't have a lot of time, run back to teach my next class. And the things that the masonry teacher was saying were evident right in front of me at that point. And I'm like, oh, wow. So I started paying attention more to my students, just paying attention to them more. And just by paying attention to them more, they would pay attention to me more. And I was like, wow, I'm not entitled to these people's attention. I have to earn this. And they don't care that what I have to say automatically, but they could care what I have to say if I give them a reason to.
Our podcast in January featured Michael Horn, an author, speaker, and a distinguished fellow at the Clayton Christensen Institute, as he discussed blended learning and the future of education. Michael is the author and co-author of multiple books, white papers, and articles on education, and was named by Tech and Learning magazine as one of the most important people in the creation and advancement of the use of technology in education. In this excerpt, he discussed the importance of individualized student learning when using a teaching model based on mastery.
Learning standards are not a bad thing, but when they're coupled with time, that's when they become a bad thing, if that makes sense. So being able to say Michael has or has not yet mastered two-digit addition, that's an important standard, right? But perhaps we should stop thinking of it as tied to the second grade standard or wherever it appears, and more, you know, is Michael continuing to make progress, checking off different standards, right? And by the way, we could have more standards that gave a more holistic picture of who Michael is throughout his learning. And then the second thing I think is we need to have a more deliberate, I think, from a public education perspective, a more deliberate conversation about what really is core, if that makes sense. And what do we think, you know, does someone really, really need by the time they get to high school or where can we allow that flourishing and individuality, right? And where do we think something's unproductive? You know, I like to joke there's a limit, I think, to the freedom over path and choice of, you know, the kid that wants to do underwater basket weaving for an entire year. I do want a teacher beside them saying, I'm going to push you a little bit, right? And I probably do want some guidelines. But, you know, constrained choices, I think, are incredibly important. And it is also the case that we aren't always linear learners in all topics, right? And, you know, particularly social studies and science and things of that nature, the notion that science should always be biology, chemistry, physics doesn't hold up, right? And so having that ability to control the path, I think, is really important for a lot of kids. And so I would love to see, rather than the MCAS, right, or the end of year assessment, as I learn different standards, I can prove mastery on them in a variety of ways, whether that's through a simple test, whether that's through a project, whether that's through a written, you know, paper, whatever it might be, I can show mastery and then have a little dashboard, if you will, right? Showing, yep, you're working on it, you haven't even looked at it yet. Sort of three indicator lights, right? And give a picture of me as the individual. And by the way, then a college might start to say, okay, Michael's mastered the basic, you know, core set of things, but then God, he went super deep in, you know, Cold War history and implications on whatever it is. And wow, like that's who he is as a unique individual. Whereas Gary, you know, you went super deep in physics or something like that. That's who you are as a unique individual. And I think that that should be how our school system evolves, which is how do we help be the best, every individual be the best unique version of themselves, as opposed to trying to compete to be the best on some very structured linear ladder that breaks apart the moment we get into the real world anyway. And we start to realize, oh, those rankings and things that I thought were so important, no one actually cares in the way that I thought they did, right? The prestige that I thought was so important, you know, maybe it pales in comparison to, you know, are my daughters happy today, right? and things of that nature. And so I think that to me is the shift. It's not standards per se that are an evil, but when they are held so tightly in terms of sequence and assumption around time, that's when they fall apart. And to me, the big shift is moving to a mastery-based learning system where we start to understand what have you mastered and be able to demonstrate and signal and show that mastery.
In March, we spoke with Issa Zimmerman, the principal of IKZ Advisors LLC, where she serves as a resource for people in Massachusetts and around the world who are interested in STEM education. As a former principal and superintendent, Issa was a pioneer in bringing technology to schools for instruction and productivity in Massachusetts and started the Massachusetts Association of School Superintendents Technology Task Force. During our conversation, she spoke about the importance of a student's education beyond what they are able to learn in the classroom.
I certainly think that education could be much more proactive in helping prepare people for the future. More requirements. I mean, people choose to do things that have nothing to do with what they need to know sometimes. So I think laying out several different, I don't mean a lot of them either, maybe three different pathways that people should be taking would be very helpful, because most people don't know what they're doing when they choose what they choose. So that's one thing. I think having opportunities outside of class to get together on a regular basis, like small groups. And I look back at James Madison High School. You know, I went to the high school where Ruth Bader Ginsburg went to high school and a few other important people. And one of the things that made my career in high school a real pleasure is that I served on the high school's newspaper, the James Madison High School newspaper. And that meant that I had a few privileges because I had to get into places that normally I wouldn't have gotten into because I was writing something about it. So I wish that kids had more of that kind of opportunity to experience high school, not just as an academic, I sit in my seat and I learn this stuff, but as a place where they could do things. I think being on the student council and writing for the newspaper, those kinds of experiences make the 4 years a really enjoyable and memorable experience.
Last month, we were joined by Ed Lambert, the executive director of the Massachusetts Business Alliance for Education, who has served in many capacities as a public servant, including as a member of the Fall River School Committee, a state representative, and the mayor of Fall River. During his conversation with JFY Executive Director Gary Kaplan, he agreed that while the MCAS assessment isn't perfect, it does help measure skills students have gained, which are necessary for success beyond high school.
You know, this idea that you have to choose between a test score and a child, I mean, it's the cure for the child that has one interested in the test score. Because if you have no interest in the test scores, then you're really not interested in determining whether or not the child has received the education they should have received, right? Or the learning that they should have, or been exposed to the learning that they should have been exposed to. And one of the major shortcomings in the Boston public schools, and in fact, when the superintendent, current superintendent first arrived, she mentioned this to me in a meeting, was how amazed she was at the lack of delivery of the standards, the curriculum standards, to students from teachers, that nobody was really being questioned about whether or not they were teaching the standards that we all in Massachusetts, including teachers, particularly teachers, have determined is necessary for graduation. right? So how can you blame kids? No one blames kids for low test scores in Boston when many of them are not even being given the content. They're not being taught that, right? So, you said earlier, you asked, you know, does it measure the right thing? Does it measure everything? MCAS does not measure everything. It was never intended to do that. But it's a very effective tool for measuring whether or not students have gained the academic and educational knowledge that they need to be successful in college and career. John Pepe from Brown University has just, you know, demonstrated through very recent research that there's a direct correlation between MCAS achievement and future success in college and career. And that, in fact, the current cut score for graduation on the MCAS is at the 8th percentile, Gary, the 8th percentile. And that when you look at student outcomes in college and career based on wage rates and other things of those students, that they're not performing well at all. So right now, at least, Massachusetts is putting a stamp of approval on a high school diploma that gives parents and students this false sense that you are ready for the future. But guess what? They find out something very different, right? When they get there, they find out that they're completely unprepared. They're given this false sense of security. Imagine the blow that happens then. But by that time, it's a lot of schools can say, well, hey, I've kind of, you know, yeah. I got them a diploma. You asked me to help them graduate.
Yeah.
I graduated them, right? But hey, guess what? It was a ghost diploma. It was not real, right? Because we didn't really do what we needed to do. Look, MCAS is not a perfect exam. None are. I think the state has decided to keep trying to evolve it in some important ways. They're doing some interesting things with the science MCAS on a pilot program that will use more, you know, simulation and the like that kind of help get past any flaws that exist in the current exam. We'd love to see us get to the point where MCAS is not something that, you know, you mark on the calendar in May and everybody dreads coming. But that assessment is done more regularly in smaller bits throughout the year so that you hardly notice it. But, you know, and you know this, Gary, right? Through the use of technology and developing software, there are other ways in which we can start to assess whether or not kids have made or earned certain competencies without having to give this academic achievement test. And there's no doubt that we can find it in that ways to also assess for things like soft skills that employers are interested in, right? Which, you know, MCAS measures in part more broadly, but we can find ways to measure competencies outside of that. So, it's not perfect. But for those that say, hey, let's get rid of it because, you know, we end up teaching to the test. I don't understand that. But that's what we're supposed to do. I mean, you know, teachers understandably give a math quiz or a science quiz, you know, on Fridays, every Friday or something like that.
Yeah.
Guess what they do during the week? They teach to that quiz.
We would like to thank all of our guests for joining us this year on a JFY Networks podcast. If you missed any of our monthly podcasts, you can always find them wherever podcasts can be found, including on our website. We hope you'll join us next month for part two of our highlight series featuring Professor Steve Dooner, Hubie Jones, Mosek Hakobian, and members of the JFY Board of Directors as we focus on how history and education are intertwined. If you have any questions or comments, please navigate to our website, jfynet.org, which also features a wealth of commentary, dialogue, and free scholastic resources to support all educational communities. Thank you for joining us. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham.